The elders have appointed tonight for a meditation on a hymn, so I'll lead that off tonight. I only have a few minutes worth of material here, so we'll have time for others if you have another that you'd like to consider or more to say about this particular one. Feel free to join me in the pulpit afterwards. Because I only have a few minutes here, I'll indulge in a little bit of a personal reflection before starting regarding Sister Carrie, who just passed away. Those of you who know the Durango congregation know that in the early 70s it split. There was a lot of church trouble. And so the congregation that built the building on the Florida Mesa split, and my parents and Anita's parents went into town, into a congregation we called the Fourth Avenue. We bought a building in town, and much of the congregation remained on the Florida Mesa. But Sister Carrie Craig, as we knew her, had a younger brother. Carrie's a little bit older than I am, and her brother was a little younger than I. His name is Clark, and he's, by the way, a close friend of Travis and Amy's, for those of you that know Travis and Amy. Brother Clark posted some remembrance photos of Sister Carrie on Facebook, and I can call them up after the service and show you, but one that's really striking to me is a picture from, I think it was a, looked like a Polaroid snap perhaps, but it said November 73 on it. And there's a group of little girls, maybe about Ivy's age, gathered around that a table at some kind of a birthday party or something. And I think there are six or seven of them, and they're all roughly my age, and nearly every one of them is dead now. It has Sister Kathy Patterson is in the picture. She was Kathy Mason at the time, and her little sister, Susan Mason, who was a classmate of mine, is gone. She died last year, and Cheryl Byrne, another classmate of mine, another sister in Christ, died 2 years ago. And Carrie died this year, and there's also a young lady in there that I remember as a little girl. Her name was Delaine Luttrell, and she's dead. So Cheryl's mother, Sister Doris Byrne, posted about that on Facebook, and I knew already that more the majority of those little girls were already dead, and that picture is only 50 years old. So I don't really have a point there. That's just a personal reflection that mortality is real. We are born to die, and it will happen soon. So take that for what it's worth. I don't claim to be preaching to you by saying that, but it is quite sobering to look at that picture and think of all those young lives that are already over. The hymn that I've chosen to speak on tonight is one of my favorites, has been for a long time, one of the classics of English hymnody. It's called How Firm a Foundation, and if you want to turn to selection number 248, we'll look at what that has to offer us tonight. It would be possible to spend many hours talking about the biblical themes that this hymn addresses, and I won't do anything like that tonight. Really, all I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about its history and speak to a few verses that it very noticeably quotes that are found in Scripture, and we'll leave that. But there's some really important themes in this hymn, and as I say, we could spend many hours, and perhaps some of the brothers, after I'm done here, might wish to expand on some of the thoughts. How Firm a Foundation. We don't know the author of either the music or the poem. Both of them are now uncertain, even though the poem is only a couple of hundred years old, or the tune. The music is a traditional American tune, or at least it's taken to be that, of unknown authorship. And the tune first appeared, the tune that we use here, which I think is typically called Firm Foundation, or Foundation, I guess it says up there at the top of the page. That tune first appeared in 1832 in a famous hymnal by Joseph Funk, which was called A Compilation of Genuine Church Music. And you may recognize that because it, in time, that hymnal became what's called Harmonia Sacra. And if you know anything about Southern gospel, you may recognize Harmonia Sacra. Joseph Funk was an American Mennonite composer, educator, and publisher. He lived from 1778 to 1862, so he died around the Civil War. He invented a shape note system. It's not the one that we use. As you know, our shape note system also arose in the American South, but it has seven shapes for do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. The shape note system that Funk invented only has four shapes, and so the shapes are used for multiple positions on the scale, and his shape note system does not persist to this day, but it still exists in copies of Harmonia Sacra, which is a historically important hymnal of Southern American hymns. Mr. Funk was born in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and he founded a singing school in what was then Mountain Valley, Virginia, and it was later renamed Singer's Glen in 1860. But Funk himself is not thought to be the author of this hymn. It's thought that he captured a traditional American melody in that book, A Compilation of Genuine Church Music, 1832. The poetry, we do have one piece of information, and by one piece I mean one letter. We know that the poetry was composed by somebody having the initial K. The poet is identified only by the initial K in the first appearance of the poem, which was in 1787 in another famous work called Ripon's Selection. It goes by the abbreviation Selection. It's a very long title. The names of books back then often carried on for paragraph length. And this one, the full title is A Selection of Hymns from the Best Authors, including a great number of originals, intended to be an appendix to Dr. Watts's Psalms and Hymns. So people refer to it as Ripon's Selection. He published it first in 1787, and it's been through several editions since then. And I found that you could actually still order copies, not from the original edition, but you can still find copies of this if you want. It was very well-known work. John Ripon was an English Baptist minister and publisher. One of the things that I think emerges from a study of the hymns is the recognition that our hymnals carry material from lots of different Christian denominations. And if we were to stick to purely Church of Christ hymn writers, we would have a much poorer selection of hymns. That's just a fact. So this poem appeared in this English Baptist minister's hymnal that goes by the abbreviated title Selection in 1787. Ripon himself lived from 1751 to 1836. He had a Baptist congregation in London. He's distinguished not only because he contributed extensively to the repertory of hymns himself, but he was in his day considered the foremost authority on the works of Isaac Watts. And Isaac Watts is perhaps the most important hymn writer that ever lived. Mr. Watts lived from 1674 to 1748. He was an English Congregationalist minister and a very famous writer of hymns. Some of the best-known hymns in the English language come from the pen of Isaac Watts, and Mr. Ripon was considered in his day the foremost authority on Isaac Watts's work. Ripon was born just a few years after Watts died. Several guesses exist as to the identity of this mysterious K, the author of the poem. The most plausible of the guesses is John Keane, who is otherwise unknown, but he is known to have been a cantor in Ripon's church in London. Cantor is a term for what we would call a song leader. If you have somebody that carries that responsibility, you might call him a cantor. So John Keane is probably the person in reference. He worked with Ripon in the congregation. It's probably his poem. And I think this poem is of a caliber comparable to the works of Isaac Watts. It is, I think, one of the finest hymns that we have. So, what I'm going to do is read it to you and cite some places where it quotes scripture, and then we'll sing it, and that'll be all I have to say about it. As I say, the themes in this hymn could bear many hours of meditation. So the first verse says, "How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can he say than to you he hath said, you who unto Jesus for refuge have fled." In the second and third verses, the author begins to quote from the book of Isaiah, and at least a couple of quotations from Isaiah are discernible in this poem. The second verse says, "Fear not, I am with thee. O be not dismayed, for I am thy God, and will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and cause thee to stand, upheld by my gracious, omnipotent hand." I guess we don't have the... So we find a quotation from Isaiah 41 and verse 10, where it says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, I will help you, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." One of the things that I observe here is that the strength of this poem is in no small measure because it's derived principally from Isaiah. And Isaiah, I think, is the finest poet of the Bible. That's an arguable position. But Isaiah clearly was a very gifted poet. In addition to his prophetic gifts, he also writes beautifully. The second verse also makes quotation to Isaiah. It says, "When through the deep waters I cause thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow. For I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress." There's one of the themes that we could very fruitfully dwell on for a while. "I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress." Here we find a quotation to Isaiah 43. Verse 2, and this verse appears not only in this stanza of the hymn, but also in the next. "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." And so, as I said, that also appears in the next verse of the hymn, which says, "When through fiery trials, thy pathway shall lie. My grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine." I will stray a little bit into the thematic material here by quoting from 2 Corinthians 12. This is not a direct quote from 2 Corinthians 12, but it calls to mind the theme of that verse. "But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Another verse that we'll consult as a piece of thematic relevance here, again, it's not a direct quote in the hymn, is in 1 Peter, the first chapter, verses 6 and 7. He says, "In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." The burning away of dross is an important metaphor in the Bible, And so this hymn makes reference to it. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. The next verse, he says, e'en down to old age, all my people shall prove my sovereign, eternal, unchangeable love. And when hoary hairs shall their temples adorn, like lambs shall they still in my bosom be born. The word hoary is not often used anymore. Hoary derives ultimately from the term hoarfrost. It refers to the frost that appears when you have fog that is frozen, and sometimes the landscape can look like you've had a snow and there's been no snow. It's the freezing of water on the surface of the earth, on the leaves and plants and the ground. That's called hoarfrost, and it looks white. And so it's an old word in English that we don't use very often anymore, but it refers to hair that looks like it has been frozen in hoarfrost. That's what hoary hair is. And it's just an old-fashioned way of saying gray-headed. It refers to old people. And there are several passages. This verse doesn't quote any of them directly. This hymn doesn't quote any of them directly. But I'll take you to one in the King James, Proverbs 16 and 31. One example of where you can find that term if you look in the older translations. Proverbs 16 and 31. So the modern English translation, ESV, says gray hair, but in the King James, which is more or less contemporary with this poem, it says, the hoary head is a crown of glory if it be found in the way of righteousness. And then 2 Samuel 12 and 3, I don't really know if this is a quotation, but it does seem to be at least a reference. He says, when hoary hairs, the author says, when hoary hairs shall their temples adorn, like lambs they shall they still in my bosom be born. 2 Samuel 12 and 3, this is in the parable that Nathan the prophet offered to David when he was found in sin. He says, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, which he had brought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and with his children, and it did eat of his own meat and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. There's a lamb born in the bosom. I presume the author is making a reference, a literary reference to this passage here, although it's not a quote. And then the final verse says, the soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no never, no never forsake. I think we can recognize in the hell endeavoring to shake the passage in Matthew's 16th chapter, I believe, I didn't write it down, when Paul makes his confession and Jesus says that on him, on that confession, the rock of that confession, that he will build his church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I presume that is, again, a literary reference, not a quotation of that passage. But we do recognize something that appears to be a direct quotation out of Hebrews in the last stanza of that verse, or the last line of that stanza, whichever is the right way to say that. Hebrews, the 13th chapter and verse 5. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee, nor forsake thee.
Let your lower lights be burning. 397, if we can use that for invitation. Isaiah, if you want to lead that one. I'd always like the song. It just had a melody that kind of rung to me. And when our kids were home, Natalie was growing up, and lighthouses were her thing. We would travel, and if we're close to the seacoast or lighthouse, we would try to make a point to go take a look at it and toured a few. And I did not, I was going to speak this evening, I didn't look up the history, but From what little I know, I think they started developing lenses in Europe for lighthouses around the late 1800s. They needed to take actually just lanterns or candlelight in to get it to refract up to the glass and shoot horizontally. So it was quite a skill, and many of the lighthouses had a lighthouse keeper. He and his family would live right there at the base, and they were responsible come calm nights or stormy nights or cloudy, they were responsible to get that light lit, because many ships, as they navigate by stars or however they navigated, they got close to the shore. They need to know, are we close? And there was a certain amount of, I guess, signaling or refractory that they could kind of tell you if this is a lighthouse on the point of this cape or this particular island. So with that said, this says the lower lights. It doesn't say the lighthouse. Let's just read a couple stanzas here. Brightly beams our Father's mercy from his lighthouse evermore. So God is our lighthouse. He is that ultimate source of truth, of light, of direction. And that's what I think it's saying. But to us, he gives the keeping of the lights along the shore. We're going to go ahead and read this, and we're going to come back and pull this all together. Next verse, dark the night of sin. So he's bringing in the spiritual context now. Has settled. Loud the angry billows roar. So the waves are beating on the shore, and the darkness of night, except this can be just darkness of sin going over our eyes, our neighbors, or whoever, that starts to blind a person. Eager eyes are watching, longing for the lights along the shore. Well, why didn't he say the lights of the lighthouse? This shore is quite a distance, 100 to 150 feet. I don't know for sure. I think they all varied. But he keeps talking about these lights along the shore. Trim your feeble lamp, my brother. Some poor sailor, tempest toss, trying now to make the harbor in the darkness may be lost. Now, the younger ones here, we're going to start talking about pirates. And I didn't realize this until we'd made one of our trips down to the Florida Keys. The Florida has a long peninsula that kind of goes down in the Caribbean, and that ends, and then there's a series of islands. We call it the Florida Keys. They're connected with a highway now, and so it's quite accessible. But down at the very bottom is kind of a famous particular key or an island called Key West, because it's very west of that chain or line of islands. And, of course, you can go through the town, and Hemingway was down there, and he had a museum and some others. And so we went to a lighthouse museum, and it was quite educational. The way many of the rich ones, they'd come from back east or up the East Coast, they actually had a train that went down into the Keys at that time, still the highway, or perhaps the Highway 2. They had some really nice mansions, big places, including Hemingway's house. And you thought, wow, that's imported from France, the china and the glass and all this and that. So you take the tour, and they said, well, I just want to make you aware, many of this were headed around the Keys, the dock in what is now Houston and Louisiana, some of those ports, but they never made it. And they'd get caught on the shallow water and the coral and crash, and they had four or five professional full-time pirate companies that would bid, oh, there's a ship to hit out there, whatever, 2-3 miles out or maybe less than that. They'd start auctioning the salvage rights for whatever was on the ship. And so one company did it, and they'd go settle with the insurance company or however they did all that, or the merchant hauling. And they'd get salvage rights, and they'd bring all that fine furniture, china, whatever, from Europe. They'd bring it over, and they'd start selling it there at their little warehouse. So you might ask, so weren't those captains a little smarter, did not hit some of the coral reefs and everything? Well, what the pirates would do, they kind of had a guaranteed income situation. They would have wagons full of dry wood, and they'd be watching. The lighthouse would be working, but if the fog started to settle in, a light from the lighthouse would disperse many ways. And I can tell you that from my personal piloting experience. I had a job in Lamar, Colorado. I had my own plane. I flew to many of the places I inspected and supervised. And I was going into Lamar after dark, late. I was tired. And as the closer I got, the locator light on the airport has about a 100-foot tower and flashes green and white alternating. And I had some instruments, but that was a very small airfield. They didn't have it fully instrumentated to bring in with instruments in fog and clouds and this and that. Long story short, the closer I got, that light disappeared behind a bank of clouds. I said, well, I know they'll to the airport, and that's about 100 foot above the airport. I'll just go down there and see if I can find it. I did. Big mistake. And that light, as close as you get in fog, in clouds, it just diffuses every which way. As I got closer, it was just like a whole sky 360 degrees lit up. And you had no sense of direction other than instruments in your plane. And even though I had some sophisticated GPS and landing equipment, it just was no way. I broke off, I gave it the gas, and I headed to the next closest town, Lahana. No vehicle there, and I just had to beg the mercy of the airport folks to get me to a hotel. So the reason I tell you that, that's what was happening in Key West, the lighthouses. God's light that's up here for the whole world to see his truth, his graciousness, his blessings. But if you're down in a life of sin or don't even really recognize God as the one and only, you're down here and at sea level, those clouds are going to block that lighthouse light as it did, which the pirates counted on that, or if it wasn't real thick fog, it would diffuse the light from the lighthouse. And pretty soon the ship said, well, I saw it, it was over there. And pretty soon you're just very disoriented. And that's the way with sin, with the world. We've been studying holiness. We read some verses in Matthew 5. You are the light unto those around you. You are a holy nation. You're a holy person, God. And Moses constantly dwelled that into God's people in the Old Testament in their 40 years in the judgment or in the wilderness headed for the Holy Land. So what these pirates should do on a nice foggy night, and I'm sure some of them may have had some connections with some of the shipping houses there in Key West, what was coming by that night or whenever, they would go down and they'd build bonfires at sea level on the beach. And that's how the ships that couldn't get a good directional fix on the lighthouse, they would watch for those lights along the shore. That's what this ship song is talking about. We, you and me, are the lights along the shore. God is up here shining the lighthouse, but many people don't recognize what it is or don't care or whatever. But we're down at the earth level running into these people, perhaps their friends, schoolmates, workmates, or whatever, and we have a chance to let our light shine unto them. So what the pirates would do, they'd see the ship would change direction if it had some navigation candle lights on it, and or purposely they would put out one fire and then move it over 400 or 500 yards close to a coral reef. They'd relight it. They were very deceptive. And then the ship captain would, you know, he couldn't see that diffused lighthouse, but he could see those lights that bounced off the waves if the fog wasn't too thick. And they counted on that for navigation, that might be a place they could throw anchor that night. They'd head for that, and they'd end up on those reefs, and you have another bounty for the pirates, and they would go and pilfer that. I want to read the chorus now. It says, "Let the lower lights," that's me, that's you, "be burning. We are the salt of the earth. We are a royal priesthood," of some of the verses we read last week. We need to let that be hot and blazing and burning. "Send a message, send a gleam," that's a reflection of a light across the waves, across the wave. And to me, this last part of this chorus, just a clincher. "Some poor, fainting, struggling seaman." This could even be a Christian that just never quite could develop a mature faith. They're still struggling with sins, struggling with their old friends, struggling with whatever. It says, "Some poor, fainting, struggling seaman," the people in the boat, the world, there's a lot in the world's boat, "you may rescue, you may save."